Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that never puts politics above prosperity. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
And joining us for the first time in our nuclear bunker is Labour PPC for Mid Worcestershire in the 2017 election, Fred Grindwad. Hello Fred.
Hi Corey, hi Steve.
Someone, of course, who would never put politics above prosperity is David Davis. Strikingly, he gave a speech to, or gave a talk, I think, to French and German business leaders, and he accused France and Germany of putting politics above prosperity in the Brexit negotiations. Something, of course, that Britain would not do.
Oh, absolutely not. No, Britain would clearly not ever play up to the gallery at home whilst trying to get a trade deal abroad and kind of forget the fact that all of the Germans and the French can actually read the English newspapers every day.
No, what I think was interesting about that, guys, is I don't know if you saw that someone dug up an old 2005 article on, I think it was the Telegraph, interview with David Davis.
I did see that, the Marie Leconte one that they put up.
Which was just like kind of really absurd, full of these kind of his passions for extreme sports and all this kind of stuff, and how he, you know, he is the ultimate go-to hero.
I missed this. Oh, wow.
It's fascinating. It's well worth looking up. I really would. And it kind of, David Davis is quite a strange character, isn't he, parading the European scene now in this kind of gung-ho kind of way, saying all kinds of daft things, falling off stages, and in a sense that our diplomatic kind of relations with the rest of Europe is reduced to this guy and, of course, Boris Johnson. I think you guys are going to talk about Boris Johnson a bit later on, so I won't spoil that one now, is, you know, really kind of, I don't know. How do we get to this?
David Davis is a bit Alan Partridge meets Ray Mears. What we're going to try and talk about, we've talked a lot on this podcast about Brexit, and I feel like in 30 years' time in our bunker, we'll still be talking about Brexit. And rather than do a retread of all the stuff that's happened in Brexit this year, I suppose something that would be interesting to talk about is how we appear to have been locked in this death spiral how we're locked in this Brexit death spiral where essentially we are putting politics over prosperity, and most of our major parties, and let's be honest, still most voters, think that it's going to go ahead, even though most people don't think it's the right thing to do now. So that's what we're going to talk about after this. Okay, so Fred, you came up with you wanted to talk about why we're putting politics above prosperity.
Yeah.
Do you want to just quickly outline your thoughts?
Yeah, I guess so. My thoughts, I'm really struggling with this kind of, you know, we're seeing all the indicators demonstrate that Brexit is damaging the country's prosperity. We've had the budget and the reaction to the budget showing how the Office of Budget Responsibility has downgraded growth over the next 5 years significantly. We're seeing kind of the, you know, stagnant wages with the idea that we're going to see decline in wages, possibly, you know, the worst decline in wages for 60 years since records began. All those kind of things are going to show, you know, we're seeing Goldman Sachs guy saying that he's getting ready to effectively move to Frankfurt, spend a lot more time there. We've seen the loss of these two agencies, which have significant numbers of jobs themselves, but drive so much of, you know, of their sector base in the UK in terms of pharmaceuticals and, of course, the finance stuff. And they're gone. They're just gone just like that. We've even seen today the kind of challenge of the European City of Culture 2023 is being kind of challenged as to whether it should go ahead in the UK because of Brexit. And we're losing so much already. And at the same time, we have all these Brexiteers saying, well, the economy's not as like what the Remain campaign said it would be yet. But in reality, we're starting to get towards that. And I think, you know, a good analysis would show that we're well on the way, if not there already. But the point is it's, you know, we could see things go along, you know, get a lot worse. And the other point is, what now, do the options really look like? And I'm getting increasingly concerned that actually we are going to be hard Brexiting in 2019. Because it just seems to me this government's incompetence just keeps getting to new levels. I mean,
yeah, I think the hard Brexit in 2019 scenario is increasingly more likely, and I think what absolutely fascinates me about this is, despite the fact that You know, Theresa May went up, gave a speech and said, actually, no, we're going to have this 2-year implementation period, not a transitional period at all, an implementation period, where we'll, you know, we'll look to hammer out some of the details of a bit more of what Brexit and what the free trade deal will look like. You still end up with like a number of the hard Brexiters. Like, I believe it was Jacob Rees-Mogg who basically said, oh, no, we can't have a continuation of the current situation post 2019. We would need to negotiate a bespoke settlement for that transitional period, which begs the question, well, if you're going to negotiate that bespoke settlement for that for that implementation period, then you're just basically negotiating for your free trade deal and that relationship anyway. So it's increasingly becoming clear to me that an awful lot of the Brexiteers will happily, to be quite honest, I think, hand over the cash that the EU wants in a number of areas. But when it comes down to the bread and butter of things that they're actually concerned with, because it's not about the money we spend or the money we spend or give to the EU, it's about the notion that that laws, for whatever reason, aren't being made, quote unquote, in Britain, and that we're putting into practice things which are set in Europe. When you have that issue kind of being the main one, and that was so much at the core of the Brexit campaign, because it was all about take back control.
But I would challenge you on that, though, because I think one of the things that, particularly if you kind of follow the Dominic Cummings role in all of this, is that Cummings quickly dismissed that because they found that it wasn't working. That kind of argument wasn't buying them significant. What really drove them over the edge was the £350 million for the NHS, mm-hmm. which kind of undermines the spend whatever it takes to get us out of here. But you know, the point of view, because we got to, that money will be taken. We'll lose that because, again, if we contribute to the EU budget currently, we get money back, we get things for that, whereas who knows what this deal looks like. The second thing, of course, is that what really drove them over the edge was the migration, whipping up the storms about migration and the Turkey mm-hmm. Threat, which, again, they falsely created. I take your point around what Jacob Rees-Mogg said, but I still don't see any of them have set out a Brexit that benefits communities, that benefits public services, and that certainly that benefits us and our families, right?
No, we haven't. but personally, I think where you see the parliamentary sovereignty point put forward is it feels like at every point in which Parliament's been involved with the Brexit process this year, whether it is voting to trigger Article 50, all the way to the Brexit mutineers headline of the Telegraph a couple of weeks ago, there's a dichotomy. On the one hand, you have Remainers saying, leave us, you said this is all about parliamentary sovereignty, and people like Bill Cash have been banging on about parliamentary sovereignty since about 1312, and they want to leave the EU, a certain band of Tory MPs want to leave the EU, so that Parliament is responsible for making its own laws. On the other hand then, the Leavers then say to the Remainers, why are you only bothered about parliamentary sovereignty now? You weren't bothered about it from 1974 to the present. And it feels like we always end up in that spiral. That's where I think parliamentary sovereignty has been a big part of the discussion.
I think you're right. I think the parliamentary sovereignty discussion is a kind of catch-all for, well, let's talk about this because so that we don't have to talk about other things, so we don't have to wrestle with the reality of what this means. We talk about how those Tory MPs go on about parliamentary sovereignty, but we know full well that they were quite happy when Thatcher overrode Parliament and all the rest of the various things that Conservative governments have done. They weren't there screaming against these things. These guys have views, which is mainly has got to be, you've got to look at it and think about some form of xenophobia here. They created the myth of the Brussels bureaucrat in the 80s, and really since then they've kind of used that to effectively build themselves their own positions, I think, in terms of media, and also excuse themselves and abdicate kind of any real responsibilities for their communities. I think let's not forget that the two people that have had perhaps the most influence on the European Union in our lifetimes are Margaret Thatcher and what she did, and then of course Jacques Delors in terms of really positive stuff in terms of the social chapter and the benefits that working people have seen from that. The idea that the Conservatives have had no influence in Brussels and it's actually not actually been a British thing that's challenged the way the EU's formed is just nonsense. I mean, I've got my own experience from sitting on trade union committees, advisory committees to the European Commission as part of the tripartite work with the ETUC and the and the European business confederations demonstrated clearly how much influence Britain had and how much Britain could go in there and cause all kinds of, you know, changes to happen.
Hmm. I think that's a lot of what else has happened this year is probably a structural issue with how we talk about the EU and Britain, which has gone on for at least 25, 30 years.
And an awful lot of that you can trace back, actually, to Boris Johnson.
Yeah.
Ironically.
New Labour is complicit in this as well to some extent, but whenever a British government is dealing with the European Union, they are essentially playing to an audience of tabloid journalists in Britain. And especially if it's a Conservative government, they are having to appease a few very, very Eurosceptic backbenchers. And I think all the major mistakes that Theresa May has done so far as Prime Minister, such as the Lancaster House speech setting out her Brexit red lines to leave the single market and customs union, the triggering of Article 50 before the British government was prepared, saying during the general election that the EU was sabotaging the election campaign when it turned out it was Nick Timothy all along, all those mistakes you can probably put down to the fact that even now, actually, trying to write the date of Britain leaving the EU in law, which all of that is based on the fact that she's trying to appease that small group of Europhobic backbenchers. And I think the reason that she especially is trying to do that is the Yes Minister thing, where maybe the EU will screw her over in 3 or 4 years' time, but her backbenchers can get rid of her at the end of next week. And it feels like a government is still playing to that audience, forgetting the fact that the EU is watching us and laughing and with increasing bemusement at what we're doing.
Indeed, I think this is going to be a real point for historians in the future. How is it that we allowed this to happen? So one of the things, you know, we've got this referendum that no one thinks, we've got to abide by, that can never be overturned, that we've just got to get on with it now. I mean, we were talking about, in our warm-up to this, we were talking about how there's probably many equivalent podcasts in the United States at the moment of Democrats thinking, how on earth have we got to this? But they all know that in 2020, they've got a chance to beat Trump and to change things. You know, we don't have that. We're not accepting that we've got one of these chances. We're potentially looking forward to an incoming Labour government, but as has been noted in other discussions, we don't know what kind of budget that Labour government's going to be able to play around with in order to improve people's lives. We may well find that, you know, that the economy is in such a disastrous state by then that it really will be a case of papering over cracks and just doing things to keep things alive rather than improving public services. And we've just kind of set this is it. We've got to go. We can have another argument maybe in 40 years. Now, we know full well that had Remain won that referendum,
we'd
still be fighting them. And they'd still be going on there, you know, because so much of those guys' identities was trapped up in this because they didn't seem to want to build an identity anywhere else. And yet we're listening to them. And the idea that a Prime Minister... Let's not forget that Theresa May has a good example in John Major, a guy who had whilst he did have a majority, it was still a very small majority, and by the end of his term it had gone. You know, he stood up to them and said, no way. Yeah. And actually, you know, in reality, you know, people look back at those the last years of the Major regime after the recovery from Black
Wednesday,
and see, you know, some positive foundations laid by Major and by Ken Clark. That's not happening here.
Now, I think an interesting consequence of this will be a lot of revisionist historical takes on the John Major years. I think we're going to see a lot of them over the last 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, there's going to be, I suspect also, potentially of Cameron as well, just in comparison of this is what reasonable conservative governments disagree with it or like it, as you do, tend to look like. This is what, you know, just an absolutely chaotic.
You don't think that Cameron, you don't think that Cameron will be seen as the person who let the genie out of the bottle, who called a referendum he didn't need to call, and then, actually, I think, why did we let this happen? I think if David Cameron had stayed as Prime Minister and just said, okay, we'll join the EEA.
I think there was a clear route that Cameron could, you know, and I do think Cameron is significantly responsible, not only for calling this referendum, which really, you know, I was completely supportive of Ed Miliband's line that, you know, we should not have a referendum on this issue and in the way it was held, is that Cameron abdicated responsibility for what he'd done. You know, there was a role for him to play saying, yeah, the people have made their statement, we're going to listen to the people, but we need a national conversation about what this looks like. We need to kind of, you know, map out what it means. We need to kind of evaluate, you know, the best routes to achieve this before we go anywhere near, and until that period is concluded, and I'm going to set maybe a timetable of 2 years to do that, we will not kind of instigate any form of departure from the European Union until we're confident about doing that successfully.
Or at the very least, we know that we have those infrastructures in place. At the very least, if we're going to be considering leaving the customs union, then let's make sure we actually have at least a plan.
Indeed. Indeed, and there's still, as many commentators have kind of suggested, if we genuinely knew what we were doing, we would be buying up the land in Dover and other areas, port areas. We'd be being significantly humble in our approach to Ireland. And one of the things that I think is so dangerous, and I think it's just been echoed this week, is just how concerning that Irish border is, how little concern the Conservative government have given to it, the contempt with which the media is starting to treat the Irish government. All these things are sowing difficult and dangerous seeds that are going to, if they grow and flower into something that's going to be really destructive and really, really problematic for everyone in the UK and in Northern Ireland. And I think gross irresponsibility with which that's been dealt with, is shocking. And again, it's fueling anti-Irish sentiment now. How much the Sun's abuse of the Irish Prime Minister was just shocking. But we know that, again, that's a kind of green lighting that says it's okay to start insulting people again now. And that, again, causes, long-term problems for the country.
I think the Irish situation in particular is symptomatic of the inward-looking nature of the British political class. I'm as complicit in this as anyone else, and probably this podcast is as much as anyone else. We've had podcasts on the American election, we've had podcasts on French and German elections. We haven't had podcasts on Irish elections.
I think we may have mentioned the Northern Irish Assembly elections as part of one, but we didn't devote an entire thing to it, despite the fact, it was actually a really significant result.
Mm. And the fact that I probably couldn't name you the significant Irish politicians on the fingers of one hand. I know the Irish Taoiseach is called Leo, but I couldn't tell you what his second name was.
Varadkar, something like that.
I think Varoufakis is the Greek
name. No,
Vandekar. Anyway.
Yeah.
We're kind of not thinking long-term about what this impact looks like. Every way you go, every which way you look, the only answer must be to remain in the European Union and to lead the European Union. I think that's where we regain our kind of sovereignty. But it's a real kind of challenge here to get from where we are now, to a positive future, I think. It's absurd that our politicians, and all of them really, are talking about a decline in the United Kingdom. We've seen the loss of the UK's representative on the UN Court of Justice. Is that the right thing?
Yes, the International Court of Justice, I think.
Yeah. That's for the first time since it was created. We've got a foreign secretary that's kind of caused all kinds of international incidents. Why he can't, who hasn't resigned? We've got two ministers of the current, the cabinet ministers who were allowed to resign rather than being sacked. We're in a mess. Mm. And I just want, I wonder, what does it look like for people who are going to be impacted negatively by Brexit in a very visible way? And I think those numbers of people will grow massively. Certainly to almost reach at least 60 to 70% of the population within 5 years. What does it all look like? How do we respond to the fact that we're no longer what we were, what we could remember we were? And what do we do about it after a period of austerity where we haven't got the investment in those kind of public services that could restore our communities or protect our communities?
And I think that to me, that what you've touched on there is probably kind of the core kind of cause of why we're kind of looking to leave the EU currently, is that for so long, Britain, and arguably you can say primarily this is actually the English, have lacked a solid foundation of who they are. That national identity has gone missing in a lot of different ways. Now, part of that is just down to the fact that, a lot of symbols of English identity, like the flag of St. George and things, have ended up being equally becoming symbols of thugs, racists and hooligans and things like that. So that it becomes very touchy to, actually display your Englishness. When you start talking about things like, on a wider context, British jobs for British workers, as Gordon Brown did, you get an awful lot of kind of sucking through the teeth of, you can't do that. And, I'm massively in favour of internationalism, massively in favour of all of those things, but I can also see why an awful lot of people, when they don't have that much necessarily themselves, and in these places which we would call left behind, are trying to find something to grab onto, and that notion of them being either English or British or whatever, is the only thing they've got. So then when an opportunity to assert that in some form, in the form of the Brexit referendum comes along, they take it.
And shake up the system too, yeah. I think.
But I just want to challenge that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because I think that is a narrative that's emerged.
Yeah.
First up, we know that probably some of the most deprived groups, the most disadvantaged mm-hmm. groups in society, those from BME backgrounds, yep. are most likely to vote Remain.
Yep.
So kind of sense of, right, okay, well, we didn't have anything, but we still value that. And that, you know, so it's not a sense, I don't think we can put a straight kind of economic, you know, neglect kind of line across this and say, well, if you're economically neglected, you're like, more likely yep. to vote. To vote Brexit. I don't think that's true. The other thing I think is that the interesting kind of stuff that seemed to come out of some of the polling, which said that if you identified with a place, and I think I haven't looked into this in terms of cities, towns, so that would be an interesting thing to think about. But certainly, if you identified with a place, you are more likely to vote Remain than if you didn't. If you identified English. And I think that's an interesting kind of thing. So I was canvassing for the Remain campaign. I was, you know, campaigning. And I, you know, you probably did end up getting more aggressive kind of behaviour from certain individuals. So perhaps I shouldn't be reading too much into this because perhaps they were kind of outliers in terms of their communities. But when I, the main message that came back to me was not because I felt, you know, we feel we've lost things, we're disadvantaged, because of immigration. And often when you kind of probed that immigration, you got an answer to saying that it was any immigrant, mm-hmm. and, you know, in their minds. And certainly more likely to be people from, you know, non-EU migrants were the problems that they thought they were getting rid of. You know, I had some debates on the campaign trail in mid-Worcestershire, you know, when I was the candidate, with some people who were really anti-migrant. And when you kind of ask, and they said that, yeah, great, we're Brexiting because of, we're going to get rid of these people. And when you ask who these people were in their communities, they wouldn't be European people. They were, you know, and certainly not the kind of stereotypes that we're provided with by the Daily Mail, people from the accession countries. But these were people who, often people who were second or third generations, you know, whose families have come in the 1960s. So there is, I think there is a kind of xenophobia here, mm-hmm. and in sense a kind of race agenda here as well.
I think there's a couple of things there. I mean, one, I'm kind of glad that you brought up the notion of like ethnic minorities voting Remain, because it's just reminded me of something else, which was in the Democratic primaries between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, it was ethnic minorities voted Clinton. Mm. You know, Bernie Sanders had much more support from you know, white liberals in effect. What was very interesting was when you kind of broke down the economic conditions, obviously ethnic minorities, as in an awful lot of the West, much poorer, you know, much less traditionally what you would consider economically stable. But what you saw with the Bernie Sanders supporters was that even though compared to the ethnic minorities, they were much more stable in that the ethnic minorities were largely happy if they had jobs, never mind, you know, a 401k or anything like that. The white liberals were in effect more concerned about the fact that they didn't have that 401k anymore. Even if you look at it as a whole and say, actually, this group of people aren't, you know, actually poor and actually that left behind in comparison, I think what you have, what you've got to remember is that these are people who have got memories of when they were doing better, and it's the fact that they've fallen back or things haven't grown or haven't continued for them in a lot of ways.
I mean, the other point with that, of course, is that we've got significant Brexit votes amongst the affluent.
Yes,
in people, you know, in the home counties. Yeah. Sorry, you know, and again, we're not questioning what will keep those people happy, because I think we know what will keep those people happy. It's basically currency exchange trading and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. Personally, I think it's a really useful narrative, the mm-hmm. left behind disadvantaged one. I think it really says to those in the Labour Party and in some aspect areas of the Conservative Party, well, we've got to respect the referendum even though we don't like it, because all these people are angry and we don't want them to get any angrier, because what else might they do? Without realising that if the economy is rubbish for those people, they're going to continue to lose. And actually, by Brexiting, we've kind of created a continued decline in their living standards. And actually, that stuff that they have now that they don't realise they have will go, perhaps. And then what happens then? But I think we've got to really be careful about the narrative. It's too easily used for me.
I think the thing with the immigration point that you were mentioning, canvassing, is the reason why we've probably got such an extreme hard Brexit interpretation from Theresa May and the government as we have is because I think especially Theresa May's advisors like Nick Tibberthy framed the Brexit result as being about immigration, and therefore what the Theresa May had to do to get a permanent Tory majority was get all those UKIP votes who were concerned about immigration from 2015. And the only way to manage migration and reduce migration figures in a significant way is to leave the single market and reduce that freedom of movement. And I think that's one of the reasons why we are locked in into that Brexit spiral, is because we haven't bothered making that positive case for immigration, as we've said on several podcasts you can do. And that's why I think we are, it's one of the reasons we are where we are, I think, because of that immigration.
I think it is, but when I started my kind of, my short retail career as a Saturday job back in the 90s, I was taught the lesson of one negative equals nine positives. Positive cases for migration have been made by many organisations, if not necessarily, the Labour Party, I guess, though. I think the Labour Party has at times tried to get some of that stuff out there. There are many kind of, but nobody is allowed to listen to them. And it's kind of the domination of the media by the Daily Mail, the Telegraph, kind of that, that makes it very hard to get that voice out there. And I think the other point is, for me, so much of this is about, deflecting attention. If we can get people to think that the reason why their community's under pressure, the resources that they are available to them and their family, is because of too many, people who don't look like them or sound like them, then it means that the real culprits who kind of taken all the money out of the system, particularly after the 2008 crash, get away with it, right? Because we're too busy kind of saying, I'm too angry about the fact that I've got a new family in my community that doesn't speak English very well, so I'm consumed in that rather than thinking about the fact that the bankers, and Gordon Brown said this in some of the interviews he gave around his biography recently, didn't see the proper due criminal process applied to what those bank guys did to the economy in 2008, right? And that hasn't happened, and that money has disappeared, and and yet it's been great to and I think go back, who benefits from Brexit? Who benefits from Brexit? The only people I can see that benefit from benefit from Brexit at the moment are currency traders. So, and I think if we looked at who funded the Leave campaigns and how much money they made in currency trading, and now we've got this idea that Owen Paterson's popped up with London, UK as a new form of Singapore, you know where this is kind of going, and it doesn't benefit those people at all.
There's two or three, you asked a question we didn't really answer earlier about what kind of Brexits are we seeing. I mean, there's two or three different ones. One of them is the Dan Hannan one, where it does seem to be all about sovereignty, and he assumes there'll be some sort of deal. So you ask him about the Irish border, there'll be some sort of deal, it doesn't matter, which you feel is head in the clouds, minus optimism, very Panglossian.
You could have a really kind of fun podcast on Dan Hannan, couldn't you, really, with all the kind of nonsense that he comes up with.
We could. I think John Elledge is making a bit of a cottage industry about it at the moment. You've got the Owen Paterson view, which is essentially, we turn into Singapore, we become a mini tax haven, which has a few problems, not least because Singapore is a bit authoritarian and a city and not really a model for Britain. But you have got, as you alluded to with the funding, there's that disaster capitalism aspect of it as well. So there is the fact that a lot of the Leave campaign funding has come from places like Legatum, from millionaires who made their money in Russia buying up assets after a financial crisis, in Japan buying up their assets after a financial crisis. People like John Redwood, for instance, who talk up the idea of Brexit in Britain, but meanwhile in their job as an advisor to investment funds are telling investors to move away from the UK, which is not something he's telling his constituents or going on News24 saying. It is a Brexit for the few, if I can use that language.
And I think that's really, 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 really spot on, Corey. I really do think this will only ever be a Brexit for the few, and it will leave the rest of us downgraded in various kind of ways, with some of our poorest in our society downgraded the most, because I think you let these guys who are running it at the moment run it, that is their aim. This is about asset stripping, it's about declining the value of the currency so that all the excellent research and design work that goes on in our industries can be can be asset stripped. We kind of keep getting promise for investment in manufacturing to kind of help grow UK the sectors, but we don't see it. We had an industrial strategy that kind of almost is kind of not being talked about. It certainly wasn't really talked about in yesterday's budget, other than just the simple skills aspect, but even that doesn't kind of really kind of fill those kind of gaps. I think if we took a look at what the UK looks like in 10 years time on the current routes it's going on, I think we're into a really scary place. And I do wonder, and I still don't understand why we're not rising up to say this can't happen. I would be really disappointed with the Norway option. I'd be really disappointed with the Norway option because we'll have lost all our sovereignty if the Norway option happens. We'll have lost some of our global standing and therefore our global capital. There will be a value lost in GDP terms. But I'd kind of, glumly accept it. really, and then start making the case as to why it's a, you know, why we need to go back in. But that must be the minimum. And yet the idea, yes, you know, that we're gonna, you know, that we've not thinking about leaving the customs union and the single market. It's just ridiculous. I mean, there is no route. No one has set out a route, and we're just jumping in into a, you know, into the dark. And why? How on earth? You know, how? Every other government that's ever pursued something like this ends up in either significant problems or into some form of totalitarianism. We've got to really think this through and start to call on ourselves what our actions must be on this.
Someone who's usually very good at rising up and saying things shouldn't happen is Jeremy Corbyn. And maybe we can just finish off by, if we're looking at why aren't people rising up, maybe just a very, very quick think about what might happen to Labour's Brexit position. Because I think Labour's Brexit position is probably key to swinging public opinion around it one way or the other. Do you think that it might be a bit of a chicken and egg situation? Do you think that Labour will switch its Brexit stance depending on how public opinion goes? Or do you take the view that Jeremy's been a Eurosceptic for 30 years, Labour are now the party of hard Brexit, which is an argument you're especially seeing a lot of Lib Dems making at the moment?
I think Jeremy's Euroscepticism is a different kind of Euroscepticism to the Brexiteers' Euroscepticism. It's a concern about how global capitalism is able to dominate kind of any kind of form of government at the moment. And I think that could equally be applied to any whatever government we end up with. So I don't see Jeremy as a leaver in that sense. And I think some of the, you know, the questions he was asking at PMQs yesterday show that actually Labour is starting to shape some of this. I think, you know, they're being very, very cautious at the moment, obviously, because what they don't want to do is get caught either side. You know, they want to lose that powder and power that they might have in later on in the process, that, you know, and that's got to be used very, very carefully if they're to avert a disaster, or at least to not be complicit in that disaster and be able to kind of, you know, remedy it when Labour come into power. I think the Lexit arguments of Gisela Stuart and others, of Kelvin Hopkins and others, have been proved to be fanciful thinking. And I think we've got to, we've got to give Jeremy the credit for not going down that route. And he again said that, he reiterated the fact that he would vote Remain if there was another referendum. But Labour has to play opposition. And I think how Labour play opposition is going to be key. I think Keir Starmer has been playing this, and Emily Thornberry have been playing very, very careful games on this. And I think, you know, with the kind of outliers within the parliamentary Labour Party, the work that Chuck Roman is doing, that Chris Leslie are doing, I think there is a kind of broadness of Labour's response that will enable Labour to move. The real question is whether Labour will, and through the parliamentary sovereignty discussion you brought up earlier, whether Labour will have that opportunity to move if we're not dragged into the mire by the current Conservative government before there's even before it gets to Parliament. You know, and a lot of the stuff that's being said, being done by David Davis and Theresa May is kind of doing things far before they even kind of get parliamentary assent to it.
Right.
One quick final thing from me. Yeah. Is that, you know, I think this is really cool. Those of us who are really concerned about Brexit, you know, I think we've really got to get our act together and really kind of come to the conclusion that we've got to stop Brexit, and put a lot of effort into doing that.
I have a feeling we might be talking about Brexit quite a lot next year as well.
And the year after that.
Hopefully we'll have stopped the nonsense in a couple of years.
That's right. It'll just be like some sort of bad dream.
Yeah, we'll still be talking about it, though. Because it will still have influenced everything else that's going on and we'll be doing.
And we'll have to do a lot of kind of repair. If we did get to my ideal position, we'd have to do an awful lot of repairing,
yeah,
won't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I appear to have written on my notepad that Phil Willis caused Brexit. I don't know what that is quite related to. I'm just going to point that out. We have a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com. We have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter @JamesCram. And we have a theme tune as well, which is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper. My Twitter handle is paperbackrioter.
Mine is @CentreRadical.
And mine is @FredGrinrod.
Happy plotting to stop Brexit, obviously.